Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm here with Robert O'Hearn. And we're across from Trent Dalton, who's come in to talk about By Sea and Stars, the story of the First Fleet. But also we're going to talk about the huge success that The Boys All Those Universe has become. Welcome, Trent.
Gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be here with you boys. And the whole Boy Swallows Universe journey really kicked off with you fellas. And I'm just so honoured to be here and be on this amazing podcast again.
Well, it's been such a great year. I mean, we got to hang out back in March before the book came out down in Hobart, before booksellers really had a good chance to see it. And then it just started to swell. So people started to talk about it behind the scenes before it started to come out. And then it started to get put into catalogs and chosen for newsletters and things like that. Because everyone's falling in love with it, one after the other. Here, Boy Swallows Universe, the proof copy went around the office. It went from person to person, knocking everyone over one by one until we're all big fans. And it seemed like that was happening in every bookshop because everywhere you go, even now, like the book came out some time ago now. Like when you think of in our terms, we're quite ruthless as booksellers. You know, the book's out 2 weeks off the shelves. To be out there in piles after 6 months or so is just brilliant. And people are just flocking to this book. How does it, like, I'm going to say, how does it feel? It feels great.
Oh, mate, it, I'll tell you, I don't know if you recall, first time I met you, John, your knowledge of books combined with your sincerity really meant the world to me because I was such a babe in the woods in terms of you put this thing in. It's a very heartfelt thing that I tried to do. Like I was basically taking all this kind of darkness and all this kind of pain and all this stuff that was running around in my head and put it into a 470-page book. You put it out there to the rest of the world, and this is even before it's published, right? And you just came up to me and you just went, mate, well done. You know, you were just like, you just said it in such a, you were just like, you sort of shook your head and you just went like, you don't even know what you've done. And I don't think I did know what I'd done. And it was so affirming to hear that from you, a man who knows so much about writing, to sort of just go, look, almost brace yourself, but like almost everything you said about it came true, man. So it was really nice. And it's sort of like, it's been really just this amazing journey. And I can't even get my head around it. And I tell you what though, I'm starting to enjoy it now. You know what I mean? Whereas, oh man, like I think I, like to the point where I think I was like it came over me physically, like the way I was affected by it. And it was really strange. I was in a really strange period when the book came out and then when people were saying lovely things about it and I couldn't take the compliments because I don't know, it's whether that's a legacy of maybe some things that I've written about in the book. It's just from the world that book is placed in and the kid that I was and the kid that Eli Bell is, that legacy has stayed with me as a 39-year-old. So all of those things played into my reaction to basically my dreams coming true, right? Yeah. It's like your dreams bloody come true. Like that was my dream.
Yeah.
Like that was it, to write something from my world and write it in a way, you know, that, well, my ridiculous ambition that sounds so stupid, but I wanted to write about the kids of Brackenridge, Brisbane, the way Dickens wrote about the kids of industrial London. That's dead set what I'd sort of had, maybe if I could do that for my town, you know, maybe I could do something. And I'm not saying I got anywhere near that, but I just set out to do something like that just spoke about them. And then you'd go around, you know, Australia and people go, gee, I'm interested in those kids from Brackenridge, you know? It's like that's just been the most beautiful thing. Yeah. And it's very hard to comprehend.
Well, we as booksellers, we start to look at books like Boy Swallows Universe as perennial hits, as books we can just safely have on the shelf and plonk in the same sort of places that we you know, there are some books that just keep on keeping on. And whether it be oldie, like Albert Facey's Fortunate Life, or whether it's Cloud Street, Tim Winton, these books just keep keeping on. And they have a life of their own. And this, just from the reaction from people that I've spoken to, readers that I've spoken to over the last few months, and you're seeing it on Twitter too. I love the stuff that you see on Twitter about the book, because of the reaction they're having to it is like the reaction we observe with these other books.
You just mention me in the same breath as A Fortunate Life. That's it's quite a thing. Like, I mean, One of the heroes in that book is this guy, Robert Bell, who's based on my dad, and A Fortunate Life, mate. It's one of the books that Dad handed me and said, you want, like, you got to read this. And it's amazing that you even say that, because this book, Boy Swallows Universe, is so steeped in that, you know, bloke kind of adventure, you know, bloke on the run, bloke on the move kind of stuff. It's beautiful you say that. And then Cloud Street is the other one that's, like you mentioned, Cloud Street. Well, so much of Cloud Street is sort of, I don't know, the DNA of it, or some aspects of Cloud Street are in Boy Swallows Universe as well. That's incredible you mentioned that. But that's the thing. I tell you one thing, and what I love is that those comments on Twitter are so, they're coming from the same place that I wrote the book, in the sense I don't think it reads like Hemingway, but it reads like a guy who sat down and just coughed his heart out.
Mm.
And that's sort of how it was a soul cough. And I just hoped it had urgency and was just like, okay, so I was taking on all the things of the longing to see, you know, my mum back in the day, or my longing to see the bloke who vanished from our lives, basically Lyle in the book, who went to prison for 10 years and had to do his time. But me as a kid wanted to see that man turn up one day on my front doorstep. That feeling never left me, the feeling of that. And so I figured if I could put that in a book and just capture that emotion, you know, let's just forget about writing fancy sentences for a bit and just get that emotion in there. And if then people might sort of feel it, if they felt the book, then, you know, maybe they'd embrace it. Yeah. And that's the thing I love.
Albert Facey was illiterate, taught himself how to write. You're much better writer than Albert Facey. I just want to put that out there. But one thing you do share with him is, this book of horrors that is called A Fortunate Life, is this guy just has this hope and this.
Oh,
and
wow.
This is what your book does. It leaves you feeling good. It's got horrors in there. Mm. It shouldn't be that way. And yet there's this life force that goes through it that leaves people feeling good at the end of it, even after all of these things. That's the same with A Fortunate Life. People feel like uplifted by this life lived like that.
It's quite cool that you brought that up. It's so great. You're so right. That's so, you know, maybe, I don't know. Maybe that's in there somewhere. That you're so right. That book is all about, A Fortunate Life. The guy, look, I know, and you read it, you're like, if you were to pick that up from Mars, oh, Fortunate Life. Okay. Oh, there's nothing fortunate about this. Freaking hell.
Take that to the what was it, ATCCC? And,
this is false. This is the saddest book ever.
But I can feel, just behind me here, there's a publicist going, are you going to talk about the bloody book? You're here actually to talk about My CN Stars, which is your new book. We can't just be spending all this time talking about your old forgotten book.
She was doing wave signs. Yeah. She was doing it behind your head for a bit there.
By CN Stars. It's the story of the first fleet. Now, how did this book come about? Why are we holding this book so soon after Boy Swallows Universe?
Yeah, well, the reason you're holding it so soon is because it was already written, really. Cheat! I know, total cheat. I've had to tell people too, like on Facebook and Twitter and stuff, everyone keeps going, Trent, you've done your second book already. And I'm like, don't categorize this as my second kind of, my sophomore novel. It's really just a little bonus kind of thing, you know? It's a little kind of palate cleanser, you know? But I'm really proud of it. It's this beautiful thing. So about a year and a half ago, the editor of the Australian newspaper, Paul Whitaker, he just happened to say to me, you know, he goes, are you into Cook? Am I into James Cook? And I'm like, well, as it turns out, James Cook is someone I really admire for so many complex and different reasons. And I know these touchy areas when you talk about this stuff, because some of the repercussions of some of the adventures that those blokes went on back in those days have caused great pain to people across Australia. So I always couch it with, you know, I admire James Cook so much for his intelligence and his compassion and his bravery is insane. His man management, the things he was able to do on that endeavor was just remarkable. The things that happened on that boat were remarkable. And there was an anniversary coming up, in which they'd sort of left England and started heading towards, you know, what would ultimately be that great voyage of discovery. And we wanted to write a big sort of spread about this amazing moment in history. And I wrote a 5-part series, and it was really well received by the readers of the Oz. And then basically it came up, it was sort of that well received. The bosses were like, Trent, all right, what do you got next? You got anything else? And I'm like, well, the next thing that happened after that was Arthur Phillip came. And we basically worked up this kind of 6-part series of, well, hang on, let's look at this moment in time. And, you know, there was a lot of great debates about how we look back on these incidents, you know, as a nation. And I thought, well, okay, before we even debate it, why don't we just find out exactly what happened? And let's just have a look at that journey itself, just as that, as it was the perfect bookend of a story, built around the most insane concept you could possibly come up with. Here's an idea. We're going to take a whole bunch of criminals and we're going to sail them 15,000 miles to a place that only a couple of people know exactly where it exists. We've got one map drawn up by a guy named James Cook on how to get there, and we'll just pop these people onto 11 ships, and we'll keep them there, and we'll start up a whole new world. And that's an insane idea. That is such a bold, foolhardy experiment. And so I was compelled by that, and then just the HBO drama. That is that journey of the First Fleet. And so I wanted to write this factual history that might read like a HBO drama, you know, so capture, drill into the characters, find it. Let's drill into the characters and find, you know, several people that we can follow throughout that 8-month voyage, you know, across the seas. And I'm talking a voyage filled with villains, heroes, tricksters, every... That real life journey of the First Fleet had every wonderful thing I love about storytelling, and it was my day job for about a month to dive headfirst into the real life diaries, like the actual things, hold them in my hands, my gloved hands, at the Library of New South Wales, and step into step into May 1787 to January 1788. What happened in that time, you know? And if I could write that, then I knew over 6 parts, we'd have just a cracking old fashioned newspaper serial. And we ran it out right to the lead up to January 26, Australia Day. So we ran it, rolled it out, and it was really, you know, it got some pretty huge feedback. Like, it was really popular. And then, you know, I was neck deep in Boy Swallow's universe world. The book hadn't come out by then. Catherine Milne had sort of given the okay on it. Catherine Milne, head of fiction at HarperCollins. And she just had been, just sort of read it on Twitter, I think. I read one of the pieces. I'd sort of like, hey guys, he's rolling out part one of, you know, this ongoing First Fleet sort of series. And she just read the first part and just went, Trent, what the hell? What's this? And, you know, and she was just like, I think we can do something with this. And I was like, oh, you know, I'd be on it if you ever wanted to. And, you know, that was it. And then, you know, we focused on Boy Swallow's universe. But this Catherine Milne, just the way her brain works is quite extraordinary. She can see things that I couldn't see. And all I saw was a 6-part newspaper serial, but she sees this beautiful little historical book. We've kind of just turned it into this little hardback and something that almost is, that feels like it belongs on one of the ships, you know. And you know, I just sort of thought, she goes, I'll package it that way and we can turn it into something tangible and beautiful and something that people could hold on and really put amongst their shelves among books, you know, that just a little thing that, you know, just a book you could buy your dad and a book you could buy your mom and go, look, here's that story. You can get it done in a plane ride, and you know, you'll have a pretty good feel about what we all need to be talking about later on, about all the very pressing things about the foundation of modern Australia.
We both read it because, you know, it's a little slip of a book, but it's a big story in a little slip of a book, and there's so much going on. What is interesting when you plonk, because you've got little excerpts from diaries and journals and the like from the people who are experiencing it at the same time, is how close they feel to us. It doesn't feel like it's oldie English Shakespeare kind of writing. It feels it feels like
I know.
Yeah, someone who's having a really bad trip on a 24-hour flight writing an email.
Doesn't it? Yeah. Doesn't it? Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and it's so. I mean, even Arthur Phillip's stuff. It's so clear and easy to read and immediate. It just feels like you're right there.
It is. It is. Yeah. It's this is the thing that struck me. The first thing that got me, and that's when I read those diaries. That's when I knew we could tell this story just as if it's just very present. And it's just that there's 1500 just, you know, poems coming out today. And just, you know, you've got the prissy one who can't handle travel. He's worried. He wishes he never left, Ralph Clark. You know, you've got the heroic ones like What Content and Arthur Phillip himself. You've got a boy who's fearing for his life and doesn't know where the hell he's going. And you've got amazing strong women on there who refuse to take orders, and you know, it's all there. But yeah, it was but you're right, the language of the way they write these things.
I thought that Cataclysm to London was difficult, but you know, I bitch and moan the whole 24 hours.
Oh, mate.
But some of the play, some of the dimensions that you describe in this, these people and the way that they just cannot move and they're stuck under there. When they hit the doldrums on the equator and they're hot and they're airless and they're farting and they're vomiting and they're...
And the water's rationed.
Yeah, just like...
And the water's rationed, exactly, yes. Exactly. Oh,
no relief.
Oh, I mean, the survival instinct of these people, it's a great testimony to the... testament to the human survival instinct of just... But you imagine being down there in those doldrums, you're exactly right. No, you know, and they've had to, there's no air in those underneath, you know, where the convicts are sitting. And just you've got scabs all over you, right? You don't want to move because every movement causes pain going through your body. So you're trying to master the ability to just sit still. I mean, the Zen-like ability to do that for 8 months, you know, like that is extraordinary.
Yeah. And then you describe that scene at the end of when they all get out. On the thunderstorm night in Sydney, and you're thinking, yeah, you can have the night. You can have one night.
That one night. I mean, that is an extraordinary moment. And Robert Hughes spoke. You know, he writes beautifully about it in The Fatal Shore. But it's basically, I mean, what they're so enjoyed. They're seeing this land called Australia through New Holland. First night, there's electricity in the air. They've found real air for the first time in 8 months. What do? A lot of them had a mass bloody, was almost, you might, some many have likened to, I'll say it in this way, to an orgy. Yeah, basically, and the officers were almost, you know what, we have to do right now. And to their credit, they went, you know, they need to get this out of their system.
Mm-hmm.
And they let them go. And it was, you know, a remarkable moment in history. And it's so glossed over. You never hear that in high school, or let alone primary school. You know, that they were so overwhelmed by the place they had found and just by the bloody sheer luck that they all survived, you know, well, many of them. And, you know, it's incredible.
And it's beautiful that Australians still celebrate that every weekend. You know, it's just gorgeous that they don't forget this night. Every weekend they get completely plastered and hook up.
Not just the second.
You might be onto something there. Like, is that the beginnings?
That's the beginning. They set the tone. Right first there. Night, boom.
First
let's go.
Night. That is the first ridiculous weekend piss up.
We just saw it on the news with the Melbourne Cup. You know.
Yeah.
All the people dressed in their finery.
Oh my god!
Sleeping, vomiting into bins.
There's a lot of young people still coming over from the same country.
And this is a beautiful book to bring this to them, because it's a small book. No one's going to be frightened of a small book of history. And when they get there, the reward at the end is so great.
There's plenty of sex at the end.
Yeah, it's sex at the end. They didn't tell them at the beginning. But
But like that, mate. It is. I wonder. You know, like that stuff is in our DNA. And you know, you couldn't get a stronger contrast between potentially 60,000 years of indigenous, you know, almost this wondrous connection to place and spirituality, and you know, the embracing of the wonders of this nation, right? And then contrast that with, you know, orgy-like mayhem almost on the first night. It was, you know, and, you know, that it showed right there just how this was going to, where this was going to go, in the sense of this was going to be complex. This is going to be a bloody complex 200 years to come, you know, 250 years. You know, it's going to, we're going to have some struggles here, and this isn't going to work. This is an ultimate positive coming up against negative situation.
I was around at the bicentennial, and for me, it's always stuck in 200. And then people keep talking about 230 and go, what do you mean 230?
Oh, no, I just did it there. Oh, no.
I haven't moved forward since
then. Oh, no, I'm getting so old myself. I know, it's always 200 years. It was 200 years ago. Yeah. Back when I was nine. Yeah, no, it's, but it is a compelling world, and that the journey for these people to get there and to get along, and for this guy, Arthur Phillip, to keep all this going on his shoulders. You know, he's got, it's a big gamble, you know. They're all, you know, everyone thinks, a lot of people think he's going to fail, you know. But this guy, just like Cook, he's a smart man. You know, these were enlightened guys who were very clever. And Arthur Phillip has a very intriguing past as potentially a spy, you know. Used to go find state secrets from all sorts of places around the port regions of the world and bring them back home. And, you know, he was a guy who been there and done that. He'd been married, married to a very wealthy woman who wanted to get a prenup, all sorts of interesting sort of things towards his past that he had left, and they were all leaving that, their worlds behind. And, you know, there was a beautiful thing, and, you know, there's parts in that book that remind me of what this country can do for people, though. You know, you can turn a negative into a positive in this place. Not to get too cheesy on you guys, but, like, I love that is that idea that ultimately, we were founded on a negative in the sense that it was a bunch of criminals coming, right? But where we got to from that negative is extraordinary. You know, this, you know, amazing multicultural, you know, forward-thinking, bright, you know, beautiful place. I know we mess up every now and then, you know, we get it all wrong sometimes, but, you know, ultimately, Australia's a pretty cool place to live, right? And, you know, and it's sort of, I find it so fascinating that it begun, you know, as that incredible kind of like, okay, we're just taking you as far away as possible to a place bordered by ocean, you know, and, you know, a prison bordered by ocean, a prisoner island, as the great Ivor Davies has said before me from White House.
One of the things I like, a lot about the sort of new perspective for me, and I've read a few things on the first.
Have you? Yeah.
Was this that each ship is like a different personality? It's a different team. Oh. It's almost like looking at a series of a heap of corporate teams, and how the hell do you manage these different groups? Because you've got these guys on this ship who are this kind of stress, these kind of people, this kind of makeup.
Yeah.
Here you've got the women, you've got the kids. The whole thing. And how do you keep control of that? Different people leading those teams.
Exactly. That's such a great insight. You're exactly right. And I really enjoy doing that. It's almost like, meanwhile, over here, you know, it's like, you know, at this time, while that's going over there, for 8 months, they all had their issues, all their problems they had to solve. So Arthur Phillip's got problems in terms of supplies. His main issue is supplies. How do I go onto these lands? And we're talking, you get to the bottom of South Africa, right? And you're seeing people strung up on poles and you know, naked and being tortured.
Yeah.
And he's got to step into that world and basically get enough food that's going to get him all the way to Botany Bay. There's blokes on the female prisoner, basically where the majority of the female prisoners are on. They're just dealing with, you know, back chat and things like strong-willed women who are just, you know, calling blokes C-words and, you know, vile sort of stuff.
It's not school project stuff.
It's not, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just because you're at the bottom. Like, they go, what else are you going to do to me? You're sending me to Botany Bay.
What else?
What else
exactly
have you got
right,
from
mate? Yeah. Like, I'm on this thing. Yeah. That's right. What are you going to do?
You can whip me, whatever. I've done
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's right. And they were in a tough place, these officers, because they didn't want to, they couldn't go back and go, oh, well, we just shot them all. You know, like, you know, you can't, you've got to make this succeed. You know, it's got to become a penal, it's got to become that prisoner island because that was the mandate. Like, it's like, it's, this is going to look very bad if it all goes south and you have to get rid of all these people. Like, it's not going to be good. So it just created that tension, and all good stories, you know, are born on that tension. And that bloody 8 months of tension, you couldn't find a more sort of tense kind of scenario than pack all these people into 11 ships.
And when you think of the next couple of fleets that came out, and their death tolls were so much higher than this first fleet. Mm. They kept most, I mean, there were deaths on the way, but it was a pretty good run.
Miraculous, wasn't it? Yeah.
Especially in the tight confines they were in. Disease that could have easily been caught on the way in different ports that they'd gone to.
Absolutely, that's what I love too. Like, you know, we never hear about just the narrow scrapes, what it was like for the guys like Watkin Tench to go on land and get on the booze and pick up a prostitute and, you know, the stops along the way, like any journey, like any great, you know, journey in history, but, you know, any journey in storytelling too. Of course, you've got to stop, you've got to take detours, and you meet all characters along the way that change the outcome, you know, and you need your strokes of luck and, you know, and just that wonderful thing called the ocean that can always change a story. You know, you can, you know, and they were constantly thrown, you know, there were storms like you wouldn't believe, you know, so, but for them to survive each one of those and get to Botany Bay, and then they get to Botany Bay, and Botany Bay isn't at all what it seems, because Joseph Banks, you know, and this is what I love too, the characters keep coming back, you know, yes. they play a role, these great characters we know, you know, these wondrous people like Joseph Banks, who's the, you know, basically this almost this cad, this very handsome, super intelligent sort of player who, you know, before he hops on Endeavour, he's sleeping with this beautiful girl, and he's basically having to leave her on the night and go, sorry, I'm going to try and find this land, this great southern land. You know, all these interesting characters keep coming back in, and you know, they're relying on the word of James Cook that, yes, this will be the right place. And then you imagine your disappointment. Oh, hang on, this isn't the right place. But if we can just keep hold our nerve, we'll find a place like you wouldn't believe, you know.
Yeah.
That's the place we're in.
I got a feeling the first bumper sticker in Australia was Joseph Banks was full of shit. Just stuck on the back of the first fleet as they left Botany Bay.
Don't bank on Banks.
Yeah, don't bank on Banks. Just get out of here. Trent, thank you so much. We could talk forever because this is a big story in a little book, and there's so much to talk about. It's just so beautifully written, and we really enjoyed writing it.
Thanks, John.
Reading it. Sorry, not writing it. We didn't write it. But yeah, and we're really happy that now we can sell a truckload for you. Thanks so much.
Oh, mate, John, Rob, it's such a joy talking to you guys about books, and it's great talking about this stuff. You know, it's fun. It's sort of, I just want to, you know, I hope, you know, that little book there that some new generation, you know, might dive in if they know that there's just a told in an interesting way. You know, this stuff should be the most, you know, it should be unputdownable. You know, it should be, you know.
I love that you said it was like a HBO thing, because that's exactly how I felt when I was reading it, not having known that was the intention. But it's just vignettes of great drama, and you can see the characters. It's lovely.
Oh, mate, that's what makes my day, mate. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you. And you can get hold of Boy Swallows Universe and By Sea and Stars at Booktopia right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.